This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The perils of holiday giving. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Americans are most generous this time of year, but before you donate, know how to ask the right questions about how the money is spent.
With so much sexual harassment in the news, a look at the psychology behind this kind of behavior.
A Christmas market in a small German town has gotten so popular, officials are asking non-locals to stay away.
Used to be we got in line for things like concert tickets or Black Friday doorbuster sales. The new trend now, camping out for grocery store grand openings.
Grocery store grand openings, especially the specialty ones. Not your traditional vanilla ShopRites or Stop and Shop or the old ones like A&P. These are more specialty stores, and people are just so excited to check them out when they come to the neighborhood.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman on why the obsession with specialty supermarket openings. She's here later in the hour. Given the trend that seems to be developing with each new allegation of sexual misconduct that comes to light, what's happening in the minds and hearts of men who are serial abusers and harassers? We're joined by psychologist Ken Druck, who's based outside San Diego. Ken, how do you see things?
Well, Gordon, you know, it used to be the allegation of the year. Now it's the allegation of the day. And, you know, we even have an election going on in Alabama where somebody who's alleged to be inappropriate with teenage girls, a serial abuser, you know, is on the, it's kind of a referendum for Alabama, but it's really a referendum for our entire nation. And it was caused by the Me Too movement, you know, which has given women the courage to speak out about the pain, humiliation, shame, what they've gone through, and women are talking.
Is this about power for the men that do these types of things?
Yeah, it is. It's the power, you know, it's the sanctioning of a society that still has deep strains of sexism, of attitudes towards women. But there are men at each end of the spectrum. There are men who do this out of immaturity. You know, they just don't know better, and they treat women with disrespect. And then there are the men who have pathological issues, who are sex addicts, who are abusers, who are serial abusers, and who have more deeply seated problems.
I don't want to go off too much of a tangent here, but when you reference the ones that are abusers, were they generally abused themselves earlier in life?
Well, we do find that a lot of people who are abusers were abused themselves. But we do find people that have become abusive, who have earned beautiful marriages with kids and great jobs and companies they run, and still they are sick because they've thrown their lives, their companies, their employees, their coworkers, and in some cases, their families under the bus.
Mm. And I think I've come to learn here, too, in covering this over the past few months, I guess. When we talk about sexual harassment, there's never just one incident.
Rarely is there one incident. There's a pattern, and there, you know, if we start doing the psychological autopsy and walking back through the history of a lot of people, sometimes it started casual and it escalated into more bold and brazen behavior. But the result is the same. We've got, you know, literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of women who are accounting and holding accountable men who have been abusive and hurtful, and they've carried that pain. So they have the courage to step forward and to call our society to accountability. And this is a great opportunity for us.
Was the Harvey Weinstein incident the watershed moment here for this?
Yeah, I think, you know, we tend to look at watershed moments because these are people who are famous. But it's really not about only about the famous people. It's about all of us. And I think every person needs to take inventory. There's an opportunity for all of us to look at the kind of attitudes that we hold and the way we act and speak to one another as men and women. And there's an opportunity in that. You know, as one mom put it to me, she said, look, with all this craziness going on, she was a big fan of Matt Lauer's. She said, with all of this and the loss of Matt Lauer and the sense of betrayal I'm feeling, I have to believe that there's a better thing in the future, that this is going to create an opportunity for our sons and daughters to live in a better, safer, more respectful world.
Mm. When you hear, for example, in Congress, that lawmakers and staffers are going to have to now go through this training, it's going to be mandatory, not voluntary, when it comes to sexual harassment, does that matter? Does that actually change someone? Or if you're a harasser that's, you know, watching some demonstration on what not to do, is not going to work?
Well, it's questionable who's going to get value and what classes are being given. I remember the classes, there was a wave of this, you know, way back in the Anita Hill days, it was a wave of sexual harassment programs being offered up on a regular basis in corporate America. And some of the classes were superficial, some of them were meaningful. Some of them yielded a dialogue between men and women that really defined the culture of that business and organization in a very redefined and a very positive way. So I think if we really take these things seriously, rather than just using these sexual harassment trainings just to go through the motions, you know, then I think there's a potential great benefit in awakening us to how people are getting hurt and how we can prevent that and make the world a safer, better place.
Thanks, Ken. Psychologist Ken Druck, based outside of San Diego. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. The holiday season is among the most difficult times of year for survivors of loss. The rituals that made them special, visiting grandparents, hanging stockings, lighting candles, maybe baking cookies or singing carols, even throwing parties, are now painful because a central figure who shared those special moments is now gone. Coping strategies from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Merry and happy are words we use around the holidays, but it's not that way for many people who have suffered a loss. Claire Ensbury of the Wall Street Journal is here with some tips on how to get through the holidays or help others cope with the season. Claire, what about the holidays make them so difficult for some people?
Well, they're times of tradition when we've always gathered with family and friends, and it's something that when someone who has always been a part of those memories is no longer there, it really magnifies the loss and sort of the reality of their absence.
What are some of the things that help people who are grieving?
Well, I think one of the things that people are so afraid of is that they will, that their loved ones will be forgotten. And people are often uncomfortable mentioning the name of the loved one or bringing up any stories because they're afraid it'll make people sad. But in reality, the people are sad. And, you know, if somebody brings up the person who has died, it sort of gives them permission to talk what's most on their mind and makes them feel more comfortable.
And Claire, often people like to hear stories about loved ones who have passed, right?
They do, because and one of the experts really brought up a good point. He says when you know more about a person, it really deepens your relationship with them. And it's really especially important for kids because, you know, they're really afraid that they're going to forget about a parent who might have died. And they also, you know, they know their mom or dad as mom or dad. And, you know, when people tell them stories about them at work or, you know, just some of the silly things they do, they keep those stories in mind, and it kind of broadens and deepens their relationship and their understanding of them.
What if you're one of those people who's worried about saying the wrong thing? How do you approach it?
Well, I think that, you know, I think it's very good just to be honest and say, look, I really don't know what to say, because in reality, you're not going to make it any better. There's, you know, it's going to be hard to comfort somebody who's deeply grieving. But that sort of honesty of, I really don't know what to say, but, you know, I feel awful. And you know, that honesty will mean something. And it's also really important to mention a person's name, you know, by, and not just say, you know, I'm sorry, you know, for the loss of your husband or wife, but mention their name. I think that that's one little thing that really means a lot.
We're speaking with Claire Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal about getting through the holidays if you're facing loss. Claire, you touched on it earlier. The holiday is all about traditions. Can you get through those traditions? Do you change traditions? How do you handle that?
Well, it's really individual because everybody grieves differently. And, you know, some people are comforted by certain traditions, even within a family. You know, somebody might be comforted by having an empty place at a table, and other people, you know, find that really painful. So I think it's really important for each family to decide on their own what makes sense to them and what they're most comfortable with, and not worry about what other people think. I talked with one family where the son died this past May, and so they are, this is their first Christmas without him, and they have a big family. And in the past, they had Christmas tree with ornaments that were given each year to each of the seven kids from an aunt and uncle. And this year they said, you know what, we just can't do those ornaments. So they're keeping them packed away, and they went out and bought a new tree and all new ornaments because they just that's just a tradition that they can't handle at this moment. And it's okay not to do something that doesn't feel comfortable. And they're switching up some traditions. They pick names. All the kids pick names to exchange gifts. And they're going to keep their son Bryson's name in there. And whoever gets his name is going to buy a gift for a charity. So they're kind of changing things up a little bit.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansbury. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Across the U.S., grand openings of specialty grocery chains such as Whole Foods Market, Stu Leonard's, and Wegmans are attracting customer hordes. Somebody compared the enthusiasm for these openings to the insanity surrounding the Beatles back in the day. Come on, man. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman. Sarah, what's going on here?
Grocery store grand openings, especially the specialty ones, not your traditional vanilla ShopRites or Stop and Shop or the old ones like A&P. These are more specialty stores, and people are just so excited to check them out when they come to the neighborhood. Sometimes they've never had one like it before, or they've driven really, really far to get to these stores, and they're just so thrilled that they're in their backyard that they're coming out in droves. And also, they're certainly incented a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times they'll offer the first 50 people in line might get a free loaf of fresh bread or a gift card. So there's also the excitement of it. They bring out sometimes live bands or DJs, and there's employees dancing, and it's a lot of fun.
Goodness. And where does this come from? Where's the hype from?
Well, it's come from a combination of things, but you've got the spread of food porn on Instagram. That's become a thing in recent years. You got all these cooking shows. You got Food Network, MasterChef, Anthony Bourdain, that have really made the whole concept of shopping a little bit sexier because there are these really cool international fare or just different brands you've never heard of. There's more exotic cheeses and hen of the woods mushrooms and all sorts of things that you would maybe have to go to a specialty store. Now they're coming to these bigger supermarkets that they have the size of a traditional vanilla supermarket of yore, but they have this greater variety of stuff, and a lot of times they have pretty good prices. So it's all these factors coming together to make it something to do and something exciting.
Wow. All right, speaking of exciting, I have to ask further. This Wegmans that opened in Hanover, New Jersey, the community affairs coordinator says it reminded her of when the Beatles came to America. I mean, really?
Yeah, I mean, Wegmans in particular, I mean, they have the largest crowds, and they don't give anything away. They're actually a bit of an anomaly. They don't give free bags or gift cards for groceries, and people just line up. So they had a little over 2,000 people on their opening day in July, and the same thing happened over in Montvale, New Jersey, I think it was in September, and they had to have 14 police officers at both openings, which Wegmans paid for, just to control traffic and make sure everybody got along nicely. I actually went to an opening in Cary, North Carolina, about 2 weeks ago, and a little bit of a fight broke out. There was one person who was not standing in line, but standing near the entrance. Some of the people online got a little uncomfortable with her presence and didn't like her there, and a little scuffle broke out, and a police officer had to come by and keep the peace. They're pretty rowdy events sometimes.
Holy cow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman. Her piece is called Activate the Crowd Control Unit. They're opening a Wegmans, talking about the big crowds that gather for some of these specialty store openings. Boy, it's almost like the traditional ones, A&P, ShopRite, or Kroger's, Stop & Shop, like they all missed the boat from what if they had opened, to 2 years ago, they would have been better off.
It's possible they don't have some of the specialty offerings that these other places do that have built a sort of cult following, and they have their own brands that are really popular. So, I mean, there have been grand store openings probably since the dawn of time in the supermarket space, and you would have maybe the mayor come out and cut the ribbon, but they weren't these events that they've become now where it's like almost like a party. I mean, you go to a Trader Joe's, they put Lay's over your head, and the employees are, you know, lining up and doing some sort of a line dance outside, and it's just it's taken to a whole nother level.
Thanks, Sarah. That is Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman, who's based in New York. I just can't believe that line in her story, comparing the craze of these openings to the Beatles back in the day. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, making an informed choice for holiday giving. Also, the national debt clock has returned from the shop in New York City. It's off by, you know, a few hundred billion dollars. And the small town in Germany that's asking out-of-towners to stay away from its Christmas market. We'll explain why in about 20 minutes. It may seem obvious that a major consequence of self-driving trucks would be a lot of unemployed truck drivers, but the reality, at least for those who drive tractor trailers, could be better jobs. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle, who points out that studies show one major potential benefit to autonomous delivery and cargo trucks would be lives saved on the road. He says the truck driver's job wouldn't necessarily be lost, it would just evolve. Rob set this up.
So there's a critical piece of legislation going through Congress right now, kind of detailing the rules surrounding self-driving vehicles. And what's holding it up are two groups. One are the Teamsters, who worried that a lot of drivers are going to be out of jobs. And the other is trial lawyers, who are worried that a lot of trial lawyers are going to be out of jobs. Now, the trial lawyers do have a point about the Teamsters is the big one that's kind of fake news, because in reviewing an awful lot of the carriers, the people that, you know, hire the drivers. One, there's thousands of drivers that they need. There's a huge shortage of drivers at the moment. This isn't going to consume that. And number two, none of them have come to the conclusion they need to get rid of drivers, because the value of the merchandise in the trucks is worth far more than they would save on losing the driver. And they need to have somebody in the truck to make sure that, you know, people don't steal them. Goods out of the trucks, and we do have situations like that where, you know, somebody's in a truck driver is in a hotel room sleeping the night away, and people break into the truck and steal all the goods. Mm. So they really need to have a body on the trucks. And the drivers right now are kind of a combination security guard, purser, anyway, keeping track of the goods that go in, making sure it's done properly, that, that what's supposed to be on the truck is on the truck, and what's not supposed to be on the truck is not on the truck. And so you still need that. We don't have a way around that particular requirement yet. And so all it is for the Teamsters or for the truck drivers would be a change in responsibility. They'd no longer really have to drive the trucks all the time, but they'd still have to guard the truck. Mm. And they still have to keep track of the goods that are on the truck.
And what about those poor trial lawyers?
The trial lawyers, we're talking about a reduction in accidents that approaches 100%.
Wow, yeah.
Some of the metrics that have a 98 to 99% reduction in accidents. And so there are a lot less reasons to go to court. And that means the number of trial lawyers you have are going to go down rather dramatically. On the other hand, anytime a human gets on the road and causes an accident, it's probably going to be spectacular because the self-driving cars drive with very tight tolerances, which means, cars within 3 inches of each other going down the road at speed. And if a human gets in that mess and screws up, they're not going to take out one car, they're going to take out 20. And so when you do have an accident, they're going to be spectacular and probably certainly at a state or national level. And so those lawyers that remain in the area will go from relatively low status, low profile, to very high status, high profile. I mean, the cases will be far more important and far more lucrative. And so while a lot of the lawyers may have to change over into something like sexual harassment, which just seems to be a very lucrative area right now, those that stay will undoubtedly make more money and have a higher profile than they had before.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's written a piece on technewsworld.com. That's entitled "The Fake News Fueling the Uproar Over Self-Driving Vehicles." What's the crystal ball say in terms of how far away we might be from this being very popular?
Well, so right now, what we've got General Motors is planning to have self-driving cabs on the road in 2019. So it's coming fast. So we're rolling down the road. One of the things I ended up the piece with, however, was the fact that we've been working on self-driving cars for 10 to 15 years. We've only been working on human-carrying drones for about 5, yet both things are entering trials at the same time.
Yeah.
The human-carrying drone thing is moving much faster than the self-driving cars, and it just amazes me that we've got very different companies in both camps. Nobody's really bridging, other than NVIDIA, which I think I called out. They're the only firm that seems to be bridging the two groups, flying people carrying drones are folks like Boeing and Airbus, and then the cars are Ford, GM, and those folks. So very, very different companies involved in both. Even though some of the profiles for the drones for the air are both car and plane, the Airbus proposal is actually you have a self-driving car, and then you have a lifting body that comes down and picks it up and carries you where it needs to go, the last few miles to the airport or wherever. So it's a fascinating convergence that not a lot of people are picking up yet, but we're talking about the beginning of the wave in 2019.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you could be with us. The holiday season is here, and historically, we tend to be more generous to charitable organizations during this time of year. But how many of us really know how our donations are being spent? You got to do your research. Here's how from Thomas Tighe, president and CEO of the medical relief nonprofit called Direct Relief. Thomas, help us out.
You know, it's such a sentimental time of year, and I think it's people are encouraged to make charitable gifts, and it's the holiday season, and I think it's important to make sure that you're just not pressed into it, and you make a well-informed, considered decision with your money. And so I think it's an important thing, and so many great groups and causes rely on charitable giving. But because it's a sentimental time, it's also subjected to be exploited. And I think that's what, sadly, you want to have people take the reflective thought and do this nice thing, but also do it thoughtfully, so that their money is actually serving the cause that they care about.
Right. All right, so what do you mean by thoughtfully?
I think, basically the two steps of, I think, making a gift is, and the first one is something that no one can do for you, and that is what you care about. I mean, There's so many causes, from animal welfare and rescue to human disease to homelessness or veterans causes or after school sports, and it's up to the individual to figure out what they care about. Once you figure that out, though, then you can go to do your homework, and it's a lot easier now than ever before to go to a website like Charity Navigator is the biggest one, and I think that is like an independent third-party rating organization that basically looks at the public and the mandatory financial disclosures that nonprofits have to do and does an assessment for the consumers and kind of shorthands it and makes a little scorecard so you can see which groups are spending how much on fundraising or general management versus their programmatic activity, which ones are running hot or looking like they might be a little wobbly financially. And those are, I think, important filters for people to consider before they make a gift. And that's a great service, I think, that exists now that didn't in years prior.
Yeah. So is it safest to just stay with some of the proven names, especially the ones that come up around natural disasters, like the Red Cross, or you mentioned animal welfare? Should you stay with names I guess?
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think some of the groups you get known by, particularly in today's economy, it's like the attention economy, someone was telling me, and so it's hard to get attention, and you got to pay to get attention and to advertise. So, but there's very little correlation between the quality of a nonprofit group's marketing materials and the quality of that organization's work. I mean, there's no correlation. Having a good, slick online social media campaign doesn't mean that you're actually doing good work.
Yeah.
It means you hired a good firm.
Yeah.
So I think it's and it's possible, particularly with local groups that are always going to be out-competed for on a marketing sense. They do amazingly good work. I mean, Direct Relief works with them all around the country. We work with over 1,200 in all 50 states that are locally run nonprofit community health centers. Now, they only exist in medically underserved areas, which sort of means low income. And they're not throwing gala events. They really could use charitable support. They're all nonprofits, and they do demonstrably good clinical work. I mean, they have good outcomes for their patients, but you kind of never hear about them because they're working in medically underserved areas. And those are the kind of groups I think that now have the potential to attract some support because they score well. They do well. They have good scorecards.
Thanks, Thomas. That is Thomas Teig. He is the president and CEO of Direct Relief, which is a medical relief nonprofit. 12 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. The holidays are here. Why not wow friends and family with a new type of gift, a package from Omaha Steaks? My wife loves the filet mignons. I'm a fan of the sausages. My kids prefer the burgers. Those meats are just part of what's in the family gift pack. To get it, visit omahasteaks.com and enter my code Gordon in the search bar for 75% off. Here's what you get in the family gift pack for less than $50. 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 boneless chicken breasts, 4 kielbasa sausages, 4 burgers, 4 potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, and an Omaha Steaks seasoning packet. Plus, for free right now, 4 additional kielbasa sausages. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code Gordon in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. The gift is guaranteed to be a hit. Again, omahasteaks.com, enter my code Gordon in the search bar. Glad you could join us. After nearly 6 months in the repair shop, the national debt clock has been remounted in New York City near Times Square. The message on the clock: the U.S. owes its creditors more than $20.5 trillion. More on the clock from Wall Street Journal columnist Anne Cadet. Anne, what have you found?
I heard the clock was coming down for repairs. The clock was first put up in 1989, and they put up a new clock in 2004, but this one was getting kind of old and faded. So the Durst family, which is a big real estate family in New York City that owns and operates the clock, they decided to take it into the shop for a repair. And it went in around June, and I went by in August to sort of watch it being repaired, and then they finally hung it back up last week. And I just thought it'd be fun to see how much the debt had gone up between June and now, and I thought, oh, it might be a couple billion dollars or so. It was $687 billion.
Wow. And you think that's fun? You think this is a joke? Is that what you're saying?
Well, sometimes numbers get so large they just turn out to be absurd.
That is true.
And the debt now is over $20 trillion. When the clock first went up in 1989, it was $2.7 billion. $2.7 trillion.
Right. And it also listed like what your family share is or your individual share, right? Something like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Seymour Durst, who I think passed away in 1995, but he was the guy who invented the clock. He used to send letters to senators back in the 80s saying your family's share of the national debt is $35,000. And now if he was going to be writing that letter, and as the clock tells us, each family's share of the debt is now, what is it, $170,000. That's a lot of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it ring a bell with people? Is this a popular thing, the national debt clock?
I think just about everyone knows the national debt clock because every time government spending is in the news and, you know, reporters need something to focus on, they'll go out to 43rd Street and take a shot of the clock. So most people know what it is. And I talked to some of the workers who refabricated and installed the sign, and they were all familiar with the clock and kind of excited to be working on it.
That's Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. A Christmas market in the German town of Velen isn't sharing its holiday cheer, asking visitors to stay away. There's been a heavy influx of tourists that have descended on the tiny village near the Dutch border. On its Facebook page, the small hamlet of Landgut Krumme wrote, "The Christmas market in the forest remains a market for visitors from the area." The Post asked that people from outside the region find another place to get their mulled wine and holiday handicrafts. Tourists from all over Germany and neighboring countries, especially Belgium and the Netherlands, flock to the country's December markets to enjoy drinks, treats, and the festive atmosphere. The local newspaper says only 75 people live in this particular place. On the first weekend of the Christmas market, thousands gathered in the hamlet, blocking the small streets for a couple of miles in every direction. Another newspaper says in Cologne, which is the site of Germany's most visited Christmas markets, a total of about 85 million people make a visit each year. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.